Hey, Rebels.
Welcome to Deeply Disturbing Things,
the podcast.
I'm Macy.
And I'm Naomi.
And we're two professional counselors who like to talk about deeply disturbing things.
And we believe laughter is the best medicine.
Join us.
Woohoo! L'chaim.
Ting. Oh, I guess it does the noise.
So right before we started recording, I had to scarf down some sushi because I've been fasting for Yom Kippur. And it just became sundown like 10 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. And because you brought sushi, I also had to scarf down sushi and I did not fast.
Sushi is our traditional way to break our fast in our family.
It's a great way to break any fast. Oh,
so good. We got some sake to go with it because you have to, you know, match up like that.
Yeah. It's good pairing.
Yeah.
So wonderful.
I'm feeling much better with some sustenance in my body.
That's good.
I mean, to be honest, I should probably be drinking water instead of sake, but
oh well. Since you've had no water in the last 24 hours.
This is liquid. It looks like water.
It does. But it smells like rubbing alcohol, so. check-ins.
What do you got?
I don't think I have like anything terribly significant this go around.
Well, we went skating last weekend and we had 5 people.
Woo! Yes, we did.
It was a pack. We had a pack.
It was a pack. It was a good time.
So that was fun. It feels like fall. Today was cold. I wore a jacket.
I bought fall boots.
I have fall boots coming in the mail.
Oh, yeah. I bought a pair and I deal with what, a portion of the population deals with, which is your calves are too big for fall boots.
Oh.
You either have to get the wide calf ones.
Oh, special boots.
Yeah, special boots.
Well, I hope they're sold in the same area as regular boots because I don't like that segregated size shopping, you know, where like big sizes are in a different area of the store. I think that's bullshit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I need like big calf for my little feet. Derby made my calves too muscular. So they're too...
You're just ripped in the calf area.
Too much. Too much gusto.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I love fall fashion because I feel like you actually can put together an outfit versus summer. You're just like, I'm wearing a tank top and shorts and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's like, it has to be like flowers or bright where this can be like, I can wear colors you actually enjoy.
Your jewel tones.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And you can layer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love the fashion aspect of fall.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the fair.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Oh,
I hadn't been to the fair in a long ass time.
During Delta? You felt good about
Well, they said everyone was wearing masks the whole time, even outside, but that was not true when I went to the fair. there were a lot of people not wearing masks. I mean, I only went there for one thing. I just wanted to take Stella to see the animals.
Yeah, that's what was always my favorite part as a kid, was going to the barns and seeing all the animals.
And the horses were actually outside, so I felt like it was okay. And we didn't stick around too long.
Yeah.
They had a sloth.
Oh, this is my favorite.
I paid $10 to have the sloth experience.
Wait, there's an experience? Well, or is there still a fair going on?
The experience is you go into this room that's hotter than Hades, and you get to look at the sloth. You can't touch it, and you get photos with the sloth. That's the sloth experience.
Oh, I hear that they're actually quite smelly.
It didn't smell, but it seemed kind of cranky.
Well, yeah, the sloth experience takes a lot out of it.
Yeah, I did feel sorry for the animals that I think that's their life, is going around to events and being stared at and petted by a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm. I would hate to be petted.
But the award-winning animals, you know, like the ones that people enter, oh, they're just like gorgeous specimens of sheep and rabbits and horses.
Remember, I showed goats and horses, but the horses
saw
weren't as
some
great.
Goats. Yeah, I was disappointed the pigs were gone already. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, what does that mean?
No, that means that they bring the big truck, the freezer truck, and they get butchered and then hung up, and people can buy the animals that were shown earlier in the fair.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah.
When the guy said, oh, the pigs were gone 2 days ago. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Yep. You go in and you can see the picture of the prize winning pig with the child as it's like hung and quartered.
Oh, yeah. It's just a different culture.
Yes. I just instantly thought of Ed Gein from the last podcast when I thought of the hanging meat.
Yeah, because that was up on...
For the deer, yeah.
Yeah, some kind of hunting thing, apparatus. Mm-hmm. Whew, that's all I've got.
Cool. You get to start off, and you've been leaving some looming statements about your topic this week, so I'm curious.
I said you would be irate, infuriated.
Yes, and I'm like, I don't quite know how to feel about that other than pre-irated.
Well, don't blow your irate wad too soon.
Okay, I won't.
I'm going to talk to you about Brock Turner, convicted rapist. There's his face.
Oh, I remember his face.
See that face?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a face of a blonde hair, blue eyed, young.
I don't know. Is he fella. In the 20s or?
He was 19 at the time of this photo. All right, settle in and get ready.
I'm so ready.
Early in the morning on January 18th, 2015, two men riding bikes on the Stanford campus spotted a man later identified as Brock Turner, age 19, on top of an unconscious woman. These two men were Swedish med students with very Swedish names.
Oh.
Brock Turner ran away, but the pair ran after him, tripped him. They did like a kind of a like put your foot out and sweep.
Like a Swedish sweep.
A Swedish sweep.
The Swedish sweep.
And he went down. They tackled him and sat on him until campus police arrived. A third person called police. So Brock was a student at Stanford and he was on the swim team. He was attending a campus fraternity party that night. He wasn't a fraternity member yet because you couldn't join fraternities until the spring. The victim, who initially remained unnamed, was not a Stanford student, but was there for the party with her sister. Santa Clara County prosecutors charged Turner with 5 felonies, including rape of an unconscious person, rape of an intoxicated person, assault with the intent to commit rape, sexual penetration of an intoxicated person, and sexual penetration of an unconscious person.
Can I just make a statement?
Yeah, make a statement.
So I had this thought yesterday of, you know, will we ever run out of topics? I know we've mentioned this briefly before. I'm really impressed you didn't spill that sake on your keyboard. That was scary. But like, will we ever run out of topics? And maybe what I think, like, that would be great if people
did better.
Took some, yeah, like, you know, listen to our podcast, hear these things. This is the warning sticker.
Learn a lesson.
Don't do these things. Learn from history. Learn from other people's fuck ups. And don't do that.
Just stop.
Just stop. And maybe then, and only then, will we run out of topics.
Run out of topics. And then we'll do a podcast on kittens or something.
We'll switch our podcast to sweetly succinct things. .com.
Sounds great.
Yeah, that's a copy right now.
But I learned of this topic actually when I was researching my last topic. I mean, I knew about this case, but it came up. Mm-hmm. As you'll see later, there's a connection, actually. So in an interview with police, Turner said he arrived at the party about 11 p.m. and kissed a few women before hooking up with the woman who was later found unconscious. So right away, we see the attitude towards women here. You know, kind of sexual objects.
Mm-hmm. I show up and make out.
Yeah, I'll kiss a few women and choose who I'm going to hook up with for the night.
I can't even think that that's like a thing that people, like the thought process. Who am I going to? That's some confidence in that child. Some egocentric. Freud would have a heyday with this young man.
Turner couldn't recall her name.
Because he's a douche.
The two witnesses said that after Turner was spotted, you know, he got up and ran away. So he knew he was doing something wrong.
Probably at the very beginning.
A campus police officer, when they arrived, found the woman lying on her side behind a dumpster. So he did this behind a dumpster. I mean, how, you know, degrading. Unconscious but breathing, she was taken to a hospital. And so he ended up being found guilty of 3 felony counts: assault with intent to commit rape of an intoxicated woman, sexually penetrating an intoxicated person with a foreign object, and sexually penetrating an unconscious person with a foreign object. The 2 other rape charges, the intent to commit rape, were not pursued by the prosecution following the results of the rape kit DNA tests, which were not released.
Hmm.
So this trial's going on in 2016, because you know how things like take a while.
Hey, there's a link to my topic.
Oh. The jury deliberated for just more than a day before reaching a verdict, and Turner faced up to 10 years in prison in the case. Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge Aaron Persky was scheduled to sentence him on June 2nd, 2016. During the trial, Turner's attorney said his client didn't know how drunk the woman was. She had a blood alcohol level of 0.24, 3 times the legal limit for driving, while Turner had a blood alcohol concentration of 2x the legal limit. Deputy District Attorney Alayla Kianersi countered that Turner's pedigree should not distract from his conduct that night. He may not look like a rapist, but he is the face of campus sexual assault, Kianersi said. After being charged, Turner voluntarily withdrew from Stanford, because everybody hated him.
Yeah, good choice.
And a university spokeswoman at this time said he was barred from even setting foot on campus, probably because he'd be drawn and quartered.
I mean,
people were pissed about this.
Yeah, again, I just want to say it'd be easier to just not before any of this happened. Just for, again, future warning if you're listening.
Well, and the district attorney said after the jury's decision was announced that he hoped the verdict would clearly reverberate through colleges and high schools anywhere
like
in our society.
Like a no-nonsense policy.
Where there might be any doubt about the distinction between consent and sexual assault. No means no, drunk means no, passed out means no, and sex without consent means sexual assault.
And if you have to put anyone behind a dumpster, you're in the wrong, period.
So you're hoping people like learned a lesson and about this. Prosecutors asked Judge Aaron Persky to sentence Turner to 6 years in prison, which was kind of the going minimum at that time, the standard. But the judge, a former prosecutor, instead gave him a 6-month term in county jail.
That's
6 months
horrible.
In county jail. So not even prison.
Well, and obviously this kid has no moral judgment at all, because just because you're drunk doesn't mean you will do this to somebody. He made a choice, drunk or not, and that's not okay.
It's not okay at all. Critics of the decision saw this as yet another example of the transgressions of a promising college athlete treated lightly at the expense of a female sexual assault victim. But the judge and probation officials noted his youth and lack of a prior criminal history. So
it always starts somewhere.
Yeah.
And if we could stop it from happening again in the next 6 years, then great. And odds are he would have like probationary release, like 4 years into that. Like there's, it buffers down with good behavior in some way or another often. So
to start at such a lenient sentence is...
Doesn't make sense. He's not going to learn anything except for he can get away with things.
Exactly. That's why I was saying, like, you hope people learn, but when people see that, you know, there isn't much consequences, how are people going to learn? So, like I mentioned, people on campus were irate because the sentence was too lenient. And the anger ended up spreading far beyond California after the emotional 12-page statement from the rape victim was published online and then went viral. So
wow.
She did a great job detailing her experience, her psychological trauma.
Yeah. Because that's going to impact her for the rest of her life. So.
Yeah. In handing down his decision, the judge, Persky, said that a stiffer sentence would have had a severe impact on Turner.
Good. Severely.
Yeah. Isn't that what we're trying for?
Severely impact that young man.
Yes, that's what we're going for here.
Wow.
And the intoxication level, for some reason, reduced the seriousness of the crime, which I don't understand at all. I don't understand
why that factors in. No, that doesn't make any sense.
I mean, am I allowed to murder somebody? And if I'm drunk, then I get a lighter sentence? It makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. So prosecutors blasted the decision.
Our topics are so close, just so you know. We have a lot of overlap.
Well, I was just listening to our menstruation water slide topic, and there were so many links.
I know.
I mean, I think at one point during mine, I even said splashdown.
No, you did. And I was like, yep.
So crazy. This,
you'll be like, wow, we picked
so crazy.
Some like the morals underneath, or the, I guess the lessons underneath, ooh, are very similar.
The punishment does not fit the crime, District Attorney Jeff Rosen said. The sentence does not factor in the true seriousness of the sexual assault or the victim's ongoing trauma. Campus rape is no different than off-campus rape.
No.
Rape is rape. I wanted to insert an F word in there, but I was quoting him and he did not use the F word.
You want me to say? Rape is fucking rape.
Stop it. It is.
I mean, unconscious, like he can't even try to say, I mean, there's nothing. There's no other than this is a judge who himself has personal values or belief systems that do not line up with no justice. Means no. Yeah. Or justice.
Yeah. So the anger over the sentence, and this is like international at this time, escalated when excerpts of the letter by Turner's father was shared online. Dan A. Turner, Brock's father, wrote that his son's every waking minute is consumed with worry, anxiety, fear, and depression. Mm. His life will never be the one that he dreamed about and worked so hard to achieve. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of his 20 plus years of life.
Yeah, but it's not like he just in that moment heard for the first time that rape was bad.
Yeah.
This is lifelong that you knew that and you did it anyways. You know, if you go and shoot somebody, that was probably the fastest 5 seconds of your life. You still shot somebody.
Yeah. And those words, 20 minutes of action, really offended people.
I'm sure. And people get more for a drug charge that only impacted themselves. Mm-hmm. So this is baffling to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rude. Downright rude.
So.
His life will never be what he envisioned it.
And there's nothing in there that even speaks to the victim's experience.
Yeah.
It's all about him. Brock Turner.
And he sounds privileged AF. I'm sure he'll be fine, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'll probably just go to another college.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't actually look up where is he now.
Well, and talk about the label that she'll have.
I decided to focus on her. Where is she now instead of
good,
where is
good.
He now?
I was going to say, I mean, like, yeah, that's the bigger part.
So, in that moving letter that was read aloud to the court, that 12-page letter, the victim called the probation officer's recommendation of a year or less in county jail a soft timeout, a mockery of the seriousness of his assaults, and of the consequences of the pain I have been forced to endure. The probation officer factored in that the defendant is youthful and has no prior convictions. In my opinion, he is old enough to know what he did was wrong. When you are 18 in this country, you can go to war. When you are 19, you're old enough to pay the consequences for attempting to rape someone. He was young, mm-hmm, but he is old enough to know better.
Yes.
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 God, victim statements always give me goosebumps.
Yeah, it's...
Mm-mm. They're so just... I don't know, they light a fire within me.
And like,
yeah, she's doing too.
Yeah. Like, does her, the outcome of her life not mean anything to this? I'm just guessing, but middle to older white man and the, judge.
And this is part of what pissed people off.
Yeah.
It Am I right? Seems like such a transgression of justice.
Yeah.
She detailed ongoing anguish, including an inability to sleep alone at night without a light on because she has nightmares of being touched. She added that she is afraid to go on walks in the evening and to attend social events. So she has PTSD.
Yeah, that's PTSD. And sexual trauma is has different layers to it that totally associate with the body and not feeling connected with yourself and feeling a lot of shame. And that's it is a very real thing that she's going through.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of time to be able to live the life she, you know, wants to live.
Counseling, like.
Yep. So Brockturner blamed the party culture and risk-taking behavior that he experienced at school. He described himself as an inexperienced drinker and party goer, which was found to not be true later. Because he was trying to act like he hadn't drank before.
He's just a little liar.
And he said he looked up to the members of his swim team who he saw hooking up with chicks. So it's all this blame. It's all this blame outward, though.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't change what happened, but
there's a lack of accountability, though.
Yeah.
Turner said the night of that night in question, he had 5 beers, 2 swigs of Fireball whiskey, and bounced around from one party to another. So, from the victim's letter. Unfortunately, after reading the defendant's statement, I am severely disappointed and feel that he has failed to exhibit sincere remorse or responsibility for his conduct. I fully respected his right to a trial, but even after 12 jurors unanimously convicted him guilty of 3 felonies, all he has admitted to doing is ingesting alcohol. Someone who cannot take full accountability for his actions does not deserve a mitigating sentence.
No.
It is deeply offensive that he would try and dilute rape with a suggestion of promiscuity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that victim blaming.
Yeah.
By definition, rape is the absence of promiscuity. Rape is the absence of consent. And it perturbs me deeply that he can't even see that distinction.
Mm-hmm. No insight.
I know. Her full 12 pages is available, and I would recommend people read it if you want to learn more about this. So people that work in sex crimes really talked about how unusual it was to have 6 months in probation in a case like this, and that the assault with intent to commit rape usually carries a prison sentence. And so a former LA County sex crimes prosecutor said, I cannot think of a similar local case where a defendant convicted by a jury of such a violent crime avoided prison. Those convictions alone should send him to prison. It's an extraordinary sentence. He'll spend just 90 days in the county jail after being convicted on 3 sexual assault charges.
Wow.
Yep. So, what am I reading next? Okay.
You don't have your glasses on. That's why.
I don't have my glasses on.
Oh, they're sitting there. You're just squinting.
I'm just squinting, giving myself wrinkles. Okay. So, the woman who said she wrote that statement, which was even read on the floor of Congress, because she was not allowed to speak freely during the trial, she could only answer questions and would frequently be interrupted by objections. Hmm. Op-eds at the time stated Brock Turner was yet another example of the advantages of being white, well-off, and educated. His mom begged the judge not to put him in prison, saying, look at him, he won't survive it.
Aww.
Which, I don't know, what does that mean? That he's pretty?
I don't know. There's so many people who get put in jail that survive it, and some who don't. But that's a different topic for a different day. The criminal justice system.
Yes, that is definitely a different topic for the different day. So I wanted to read a little bit from actual court documents. Mm-hmm. And some of this is graphic because it's actual court mm-hmm. documents. So this is the one of the officer's statements here. So I approached Deputy Taylor, who was ensuring the victim was breathing. The victim is wearing a black skin tight dress, which I didn't like that word. I didn't like how they point. Tight. Like, why was that necessary to say?
No,
it doesn't matter what she's wearing.
No,
she'd be wearing a fucking garbage bag. You still don't rape her.
Mm-hmm. She could be wearing a bra and underwear, and you'd be like, "Are you okay? Why are you out here? Let's get you dressed."
Yeah. So that bothered me. Yes. I just wanted to point that out. I noticed that her dress was pulled up to her waist, exposing her vagina and butt. She was not wearing any underwear. The back of her black dress was covered in pine needles. The back of her neck was visible, and her long hair was disheveled, knotted, and completely covered in pine needles. She was wearing brown boots that were still laced, with the laces tied in a bow. There were zippers on the heels of her shoes that were in the fully zipped up position. She was lying in a position with her feet and legs bent in a 45 to 90 degree angle, fetal position, and her arms were in front of her chest, with her hands on the ground near her face. So she's protecting herself.
Mm-hmm, that's self-defensive.
She's fetal and she's protective. She had a light gray sweatshirt that was removed from her right arm, but was still on her left arm between the ground and her left arm. So he just like ripped her clothes down. The extra sweater material was bunched up in front of her on the ground. Her dress was pulled up the front of her body as well, above her waist, and her lower abdomen and pubic area was visible. She was wearing a bra, however, it appeared very disheveled, with part of it exposed outside of her dress. The top of her dress was stretched down over both of her shoulders. She was wearing a necklace that had feathers as a pendant. The necklace was wrapped around all the way around her neck, so the pendant portion was now centered on her back. So they found her, again, behind a dumpster, like laying in a pile of pine needles. So one of the Swedish med students, Johnson, but it's spelled with like a lot of extra N's and S's in the middle.
Johnson
said that
he had long Johnson.
So they interviewed them separately and they had the exact same story. So they both talked about how they found him on top of the girl and that they said, this is when they told the med students to get off so they could cuff him. Turner had a strong odor of an alcoholic beverage emanating from his person. I noticed that his pants seemed disheveled around his crotch area, and he had what appeared to be a cylindrical bulge consistent with an erect penis underneath his pants.
Gross.
He had dirt on his face and shirt as if he had been in a physical struggle. So, I mean, what were your thoughts so far on this police report?
It's really sad. And he's really gross and bad.
Yes. So both of the med students described the same thing. They were interviewed separately about how they were riding by and they noticed them and became concerned because the victim looked obviously unconscious. And so when the guy ran away, Turner ran away, they really realized, okay, something was wrong.
Yeah, which again, if he's like, I didn't know, if he thought that was consensual, why did he get up and run then?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he obviously knew what he was doing was wrong. So, done.
So Johnson said he did not see if Turner had his pants undone or his penis out, but stated it definitely looked like Turner was having sex with the victim due to the thrusting and him being on top of her with her dress pulled up.
Yep.
So the other Swedish med student fellow said the same thing, that he looked over to the female and male on the ground and said he saw the male subject and then saw Turner thrust or hump the female about 10 times. He also noticed that it appeared like the female was not moving and something seemed odd. So that's when He got off his bike and started to approach, and then Turner got up and ran away. Mm. So they have the same story, which mm-hmm. is always good. Okay, so the victim was transported at about 1:30 in the morning by a medic to Valley Medical Center in San Jose. And so the officer said they rode with the victim in the back of the ambulance, and she remained unconscious throughout the entire ride and was still unconscious during the check-in process at the hospital. So can you imagine?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it'd be so scary.
I have never experienced like that level of unconsciousness where mm-hmm. I wouldn't wake up during, you know, an ambulance ride or something.
And you've had concussions.
I know, right? Approximately every 15 minutes, I attempted to ask the victim in a very loud voice, "Can you hear me? What is your name?" I did not receive any kind of response from the victim until approximately 4:15 in the morning. Mm. And at that time, the victim regained consciousness and slowly began to talk. After I was able to identify the victim, I let her know where she was and why. She stated she understood. I asked the victim if she would be willing to go through a sexual assault response team procedure, and she stated, "Yes, I will." So can you imagine that's how you learn that you were raped, is waking up in a hospital?
And so was her unconsciousness that long? Was that due to alcohol poisoning, or was that due to injury during the assault?
I think it was alcohol poisoning, but...
Did they, like, pump her stomach?
I didn't learn that they pumped her stomach. I also didn't learn, like, that he maybe, like, punched her or anything that would have knocked her out.
Like, so. There was no head wound or anything that. But, I mean, she... I don't know.
Yep.
It just seems like a long time to be passed out and non-responsive for.
A long time, yeah.
It's a long... Like, so to me, it's... Either, like, you know, at that point, he should have, you know, you're unconscious. You obviously need to go to the hospital because you have alcohol poisoning that could kill you.
You're non-responsive.
Yeah, that's like. Yeah.
That's what.
She could have died just from alcohol poisoning in that time frame.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. That's scary.
And waking up in the hospital having no memory of what happened. I mean.
Yeah.
I just can't even imagine that. So Turner was released after serving 3 months in county jail. 90 days, 3 months.
Wow.
He was released early for good behavior.
What about serving for your consequences? Like, can that hold first before? Like, you should have your base, like, no matter what, it's this much. Let alone the fact that I think that's way too short. But that much no matter what. And we're going to give you an extra year. And that's the year you can play around with good behavior. But no matter what, here's your minimum.
In prison.
Yes, in prison.
If you're going to do big boy crimes, you need to do big boy time.
Yep. What do you think? You're special? You're not special.
Well, he was treated as if he was special.
He's not special.
I don't think any good lessons were learned here.
No.
In the June 5th, 2018 primary election, nearly 200,000 Santa Clara County voters turned out, voting to remove Judge Persky by a margin of over 23%. Persky was the first judge to be recalled by voters in California in 86 years and the first in the U.S. since 1977.
Mm-hmm.
People were just not okay with his sentencing.
No. 2016, dude. Come on.
Yes. So the young woman in this case, who is referred to throughout this as the victim or the unconscious woman, she was not originally named, and in the court proceedings was referred to as Emily Doe. So they gave her a pseudonym. In 2019, Chanel Miller relinquished her anonymity and released an autobiography entitled Know My Name, a memoir, in which she discusses the assault, the trial, and the aftermath. She had to research the court documents to learn what happened to her.
Ugh.
Documents that were too overwhelming for her to view at the time. She said the Me Too movement helped her feel she could come forward with her identity.
Mm-hmm.
For 5 years, she had to live a compartmentalized life, and it had begun to make her feel fragmented.
Yeah, pretending to be someone else.
Yeah. And not being able to just
be honest,
be whole yeah. with things. Mm-hmm. She said the book was an attempt to reappropriate her narrative and describe the trauma she went through after being referred to repeatedly in the press as the unconscious, intoxicated woman. She wanted to tell her so. And that's her face.
Mm-hmm.
Not creepy like the other one.
No.
She's Asian. In her memoir, Miss Miller writes about how growing up Asian American made her feel used to being unseen, to never being fully known.
Wow.
And it did not feel possible that I could be the protagonist. So why does it matter that Chanel Miller is Asian? So in a op-ed piece by Lisa Koh for the New York Times that I read, she wrote, Asian American women intersect with racism and sexism in ways that are shared by women of other races and also unique to us. It's impossible to acknowledge the dehumanization of and violence against Asian women, including hypersexualization, eroticization, and fetishization, without connecting it to a long history of American colonialism, imperialism, and militarization in Asian countries.
Yeah.
I mean, remember I talked about the comfort women of World War II?
Yeah.
And also about the women that were killed, was that last year or this year? That were shot? And murdered in the U.S. You remember that?
I don't. Like, we'd need a podcast name.
We talked about it during check-in.
Gotcha.
Following this case, state legislators approved the two measures. AB 2888, which eliminates probation as an option for offenders whose victims are intoxicated or unconscious, while AB 701 expands the state's definition of rape beyond the use or threat of physical force. Before these new laws, those convicted of rape using additional physical force must serve prison time, but offenders like Turner, convicted of sexually assaulting someone who is unconscious or incapable of giving consent because of intoxication, can receive a lesser sentence.
That's so messed
bullshit.
Up.
Rape has previously been defined as an act of sexual intercourse under certain conditions of force, duress, or lack of consent. Other types of sexual assault, like penetration with a foreign object, in this case, were categorized as separate offenses. I believe he was going to rape her with his penis, but just got caught.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think he was just working up to that.
Yeah.
Because as the campus police said, he had a big old stiffy there. As a tie-in to our last episode, following his light sentence of 6 months in county jail, hundreds of practicing witches, like 600, got together to perform a mass virtual hex on Brock Turner.
Wow. Okay. All right.
It was a way to channel the powerlessness and rage. So this was organized through Facebook, and as a suggestion for how to do the hex, using a black candle and a photo or representation of Turner, wrapping it with a string, and chanting the following hex. In the most holy name of Hecate, the goddess of life and death, she who holds the key to the underworld, let this rapist meet justice. Let him be destroyed. Brock Allen Turner, we hex you. You will be impotent. You will know constant pain of pine needles in your guts. Food will bring you no sustenance. In water, your lungs will fail you. Sleep will only bring nightmares. Shame will be your mantle. You will meet justice. My witchcraft is strong. Our witchcraft is powerful. The spell will work. So mote it be. And in a link to a couple podcasts ago, some women anointed their candles in menstrual blood.
Oh. Just to really seal the deal, huh?
A few women also conducted positive ceremonies, lighting candles for the victim and those who saved her, and sending positive energy to the other witches. So to wrap it up, in her memoir, Chanel Miller, who is also an artist, writes, "I am not Brock Turner's victim. Mm-hmm. I am not his anything. Mm-hmm. I don't belong to him.
No.
I am also half Chinese. My Chinese name is Zhang Xiaoxia," probably butchered that, "which translates to Little Summer."
Aww.
And that's the story of Chanel Miller, Survivor.
It's one thing I've really enjoyed in our podcast is kind of, because you hear all these news stories and events that happen, and they are very perpetrator focused, and you often don't remember the name, or even if you get a name of a victim, you know, of these perpetrators, and it is focused so much on the horrors of what happened versus what about their experience and how are they now just as a person.
Yeah. I mean, why do more people know Brock Turner's name than Chanel Miller's name?
Yeah.
Like, that's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get more sake.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, I guess I have to take my headphones
off.
I was tethered.
All right, be quiet. We can't have the little one know that the door's open. See how quick she can be. Oh, she's fast with the sake. She's back. Okay. So, okay.
What do you got?
My topic.
What do you got?
My topic was interesting. Okay. Have you heard of Bob Durst?
I don't know.
Okay.
All maybe. Right. I mean, okay. Sometimes I know the story, but I forget names.
That's okay. So this is a current event. I'm full. Oh. I'm full. Oh, now your table's full. Here, let me sip that.
It was so clear. It looked empty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry. Bob Durst, or Robert Durst is full name. So this is current. This man is currently in trial. It was prolonged. It started back up in April. It's been prolonged for, because of COVID, they paused his sentencing and court.
Okay.
So it just started back up. There was over 56, let's see here, so 3 weeks total of time in trial, and over 56 hours of back and forth cross testimony of the witness. So this very long, tedious court trials, all the way up to a couple days ago, the jurors have started reviewing and weighing out the decision as of yesterday, and as of today there's no updates. So not a quick decision. They're still deliberating. So I'm hoping that by next time we meet, we'll have a verdict for what we're going to talk about today.
We both had court trial stuff.
We did. And
we're so
when
linked.
I talk about this fella, you will see more links. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Robert Durst, I'm actually going to start with really the court part of it. I sat and watched all of the court trials because you can watch it all now. It's all just accessible on YouTube. And he is in his 70s now, so he's old. And he – have you heard of The Jinx?
What do you mean?
So HBO show?
No.
2015 television show?
No.
Okay. Let me give a little backstory.
Okay.
Okay, so Robert Durst, first of all, just to give some background of who he is, he's a heir to a real estate fortune, like $4.4 billion heir. He was recently arrested in connection to unsolved murder of his friend, supposedly his best friend, who investigators believe knew about the disappearance of his estranged wife from back in the 80s.
Oh.
So during Durst's troubled history with the law, and his alleged involvement in up to 3 murders, it prompted a movie and then an HBO series about his life. So there was a movie called, what was it called? Hold on, I wrote it down. It was called All Good Things. And this was a show that talked about the disappearance of his wife and made some inferences and was trying to put things together. They didn't like correspond with him at all about this. He then reached out to them and he wanted to make a documentary about the disappearance of his wife. So he reached out to initiate that, which ended up being called the show The Jinx.
So he was involved in creating a documentary about his own thing.
Yes. Like, he literally did the
maybe
call.
Maybe guilty of? Allegedly guilty?
Yes. Sorry, trying to pull up the thing. Okay.
That speaks of so much narcissism right there. Like, I am right? So crafty.
This is his picture right there of him right now. Oh. Yeah, just so you have a face. But, like, he, you know, not a super intimidating looking man. He was born in 1943. So he's the son of the New York City businessman Seymour Durst. His elder brother, Douglas Durst, is now the head of the Durst organization. So a little backstory is Robert Durst is the eldest. He should have been the heir to the company. However, due to some eccentric behaviors, his father gave it to his younger brother.
Oh.
Who they have a tumultuous relationship.
That never turns out well when you go out of order with those kind of things.
No. So he's suspected of having murdered 3 people. Kathleen McCormick Durst, his wife, his first wife, who disappeared in New York in 1982. Then Susan Berman, his longtime friend, was killed in L.A. in 2000. And then his neighbor, Morris Black, who was killed in Texas in 2001.
So we have a serial killer in our hands, folks.
But not a traditional one. So here's you'll see. So he was the subject of a manhunt after Black's body parts were found floating in the Galveston Bay. So they actually found each body part was put into like black trash bags and they found them floating in the bay.
Anytime dismemberment is involved, we're dealing with a whole different
ball game, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So they found the body parts floating around. I saw it's actually The Jinx is on HBO. You can see it. They go through all these details if you want to, you know, see all that. It was, you know, stuff. I didn't need to see the toes, but you do. And, you know, you see the pieces.
I'm really good at looking away or looking through a filtered hand.
Yes. You'll definitely need that for this. So among the many theories regarding Kathy Durst, his wife's disappearance, is that Durst may be dismembered and buried his wife or something similar in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. There's no evidence, no fingerprints, no nothing about the disappearance of his wife. Never investigated.
Never investigated.
No. So this is currently about Morris Black, and that was in 2001.
Okay.
And then the disappearance of his best friend, Susan Berman, was in 2000, so the year prior. Okay. Just those timelines will start to make sense. Okay. March 14th, 2015. Durst was arrested in New Orleans on a first-degree murder warrant in relation to the Berman killing, so his best friend. In 2016, he was transferred to California, and in 2018, a judge ruled that there was sufficient evidence for him to be tried for the death of Berman. That's when he began the trial March 2nd, 2020. Postponed due to COVID, additional delays to May 17, 2021, and now they're just now resuming it and waiting for a verdict. So that's the timeline we're in.
The suspense.
Right? Okay, so I want to go a little backstory on Durst.
Okay.
So we know his dad, we know his brother. So when he was 7, his mom died as a result of a fall from their roof. Ooh. They don't know if it was suicide or accident. He did witness the fall of his mom. So As children, Robert and Douglas underwent counseling for sibling rivalry. And in 1953, a psychiatrist report. So 1953, this is only a year after the first DSM came out.
Okay.
So the report on the 10-year-old mentioned personality decomposition and possibly schizophrenia.
For him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So obviously personality decomposition isn't a term we use.
No.
No, that's not a common
term. I mean, what would be something similar now? Like DID or?
I mean, my mind goes to like dementia, but I don't even think that's what they mean. Mm-hmm. But I think that was just before when they just kind of got labeled with whatever sounded okay. Right?
I mean, it sounds like a diagnosis.
It does. And I don't, after everything I looked at, I don't agree with schizophrenia either. And I'll kind of go into why I don't at the end.
So they were already...
There's already stuff.
Sibling rivals, and then the dad tragic loss. Makes it worse by, going out of order with the inheritance mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm.
So Durst attended Scarsdale High School. He was described as a loner. He earned a BA in economics, a varsity lacrosse team member, business manager of the Brown and White student newspaper. Durst enrolled in a doctoral program at UCLA, which, by the way, he never actually completed his degree there, but he often says that he's a master's graduate, but he never finished. Durst eventually became a real estate developer in the Durst organization. However, 1992, his brother took over the business, and it really had... So his brother, when his brother talked about it, he said that Durst, or that... Robert Bob just stopped coming into work, and so that's how he eventually completely left the company.
If he was going to kill anybody, I mean, I would have predicted he would kill the brother.
Yeah. So this point, he did try to sue his family for money and the fortune, which I don't think actually came out to anything. Okay, so let's talk about the crimes that are being investigated.
Okay,
so his wife first. She was a medical student. After two dates, he invited her to share his home in Vermont, where he had opened a health food store. She moved there in 1972. His father pressured him to move back to New York to be involved in the work family business. The couple then returned to Manhattan, where they got married on Durst's 13th birthday.
What? They got married when they were 13?
He was, oh, sorry, did I say 13? Sorry, 30th birthday. Oh. That's my sake.
Wow.
On the second topic.
This is a different topic.
No, just kidding. Okay, so McCormick was a student in her fourth and final year at the College of Medicine in the Bronx. She was studying to be a pediatrician when she disappeared. She was only a few months short of earning her degree. McCormick was last seen by someone other than Durst, was not seen by anyone other than Durst before the evening of January 31st, 1982. She appeared unexpectedly at a dinner party, and her friend noticed that McCormick was upset, was wearing red sweatpants, which they thought was odd, because she often dressed in really nice clothes, and McCormick later left for her home after a phone call from her husband. Although the couple argued and fought that evening, Durst maintained that he put his wife on the commuter train to New York City, had a drink with a neighbor, and spoke to his wife in their Manhattan apartment by telephone later that evening. Durst later admitted he just went home and went to bed. "That's what I told police," he said later in the documentary. "I was hoping that would just make everything go away." So I will say that this documentary that he voluntarily put himself into screwed him in a lot of his lies throughout all of this. Some narcissistic traits of feeling like he needed to share things got him in trouble both in sharing in the jinx and later on in late 2015, he was asked if he would interview with, I believe, the LA police department. He agreed. And he does a voluntary interview with them before there's actually any charges against him. And some of the things he says are like, excuse me, what? And
so he dug himself into his own
huge hole. Because that person who was interviewing him ended up being his prosecutor in the case that he's in right now. Okay. So, So,
fall allergies.
It's not COVID, I promise. That's okay. So, it was 4 days before he reported his wife missing. He did file a missing person report. A doorman in the building and superintendent of the couple's apartment claimed to have seen McDormick there on February 1st, the day after she was last seen. But Durst's own criminal lawyer later reported that the doorman said he had not seen her arrive at all and may not have even been working that night.
So there's questions about what really happened.
There's questions. Remember, this guy like comes from a lot of money, a lot of privilege, a lot of I do whatever I want. And he continues, even in the trials that he's in, I was watching and the prosecutor goes, you know, I've heard you be called Robert, Bob, Mr. Durst, how would you like me to call you? And he just looks at him straight face and he says, how about sir? And it's just, and you're like, oh, okay, here's where we're starting.
Oh, snap.
He's very sassy, very, but very emotionally detached from everything he talks about. Just deadpan face the whole time. He talked about his wife getting pregnant at one point and her wanting the baby, him not wanting it, him telling her he didn't want it. She went along with what he said. He took her to go get an abortion, but all very unemotional statements. There was reports of physical abuse by him towards his wife. And he said that she later was asking for a divorce.
Do you think that's where the motivation is?
And was asking for a lot of money. And he said that the physical abuse came up only to try to get more money out of him. That like that would give her more money.
So is that the motivation? She was leaving him and trying to take his money?
Maybe. He denies anything to do with the disappearance of his wife still. So a few weeks before she disappeared, she was being treated at the Bronx Hospital for facial bruises.
Oh.
Yeah. She had told her friend that Durst had beat her up, but to not press charges. So she didn't want any charges pressed. McDormick asked Durst for $250,000 divorce settlement. Instead, Durst canceled his wife's credit card, removed her name from the joint bank account, and refused to pay her medical school tuition. At the time McCormick disappeared, Durst had been dating Prudence Farrow for 3 years and was living in a separate apartment.
What? He had a secret life?
Right. Durst initially offered $100,000 for his wife's return and then reduced the reward to $15,000.
That's a big change.
Yeah. Only 3 weeks after Durst reported McCormick missing, the superintendent at the Riverside Drive apartment found her possessions in the building's trash compactor.
Suspicious.
Mm-hmm. When one of McCormick's friends and her sister found out that she had been reported missing, they broke into her cottage hoping to find her there, like maybe she ran there for safety. Instead, it was ransacked. It had been gone through. McCormick's mail left unopened and her belongings all in the trash. Suspect, right?
Very suspect.
Very suspect. So she went missing. There was a missing person claim. He claimed that last time he saw her was at the Katana station that he dropped her off at, where she was going to be leaving for school. She was planning to board at 9:15. He also claimed that on February 4th, the supervisor from the medical school bus called him and said that she called in sick February 1st and was absent from class for the entire week. It was uncertain if it was actually McCormick who made the call. So the day after Durst received the call from McCormick's medical school, he reported her as missing. The police found the story to be full of contradictions. So how could she have called? How could she have called the school to tell them she wasn't going to be there when she was already reported missing?
Already reported missing.
Yeah. So like there's, it just doesn't quite make sense.
No, that timeline doesn't make sense.
No. And all of her personal belongings are in trash compactors. So she obviously didn't have anything to take with her wherever she went. 8 years after McCormick's, so nothing came from that. 8 years after McCormick's disappearance, Durst divorced her, claiming spousal abandonment.
Oh, blaming her.
In 2016, the McCormick family asked to have Kathleen declared legally dead. It was granted the following year. Kathleen's mother attempted to sue Durst for $100 million, alleging that he killed her and deprived them of the right to bury her. McCormick's parents are now deceased. Her younger sister, Hughes, also believed that Durst murdered her. The New York State Police quietly reopened the criminal investigation in 1999, searching Durst's former South Salem residence for the first time. And that just became public in 2000.
So why wasn't it ever investigated?
Oh, I think, again, there's a lot. The further we go back, there's all these holes in investigation, like assuming someone's good, which, again, linking back to Ed Gein of like, he doesn't look intimidated. He doesn't look like somebody who would do that. And he's intelligent. He knows what to say to people. He knows how to gauge reactions of people.
I mean, if they had investigated it when things were fresh, they may have found more than, you know, 10 years after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, they said they didn't find any physical evidence. But if he dismembered her body, like if there's no body to be found, then yeah, that's hard to do. And yeah, investigating his house in 2000 that you never even looked at.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
It's been cleaned by then.
It's been cleaned. Yes. So in 2019, there was a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the sister, which accused him of murdering the wife. It was dismissed on the grounds that she had waited too long. Ugh. The death date had been changed to be most likely at the time she disappeared in 1982 due to the murder, instead of the previous determination in 1987 for a missing person. So they're like, meh, too bad, you don't fit our timeline.
Stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the family has instincts, and if they feel like he killed her, there might be something there.
So part of this new investigation, however, on May 17th, 2021, Westchester County, New York District Attorney said that the disappearance of Kathleen McCormick Durst has been reclassified as murder and would be reinvestigated.
Ooh, here we go.
Mm-hmm. All right. Susan Berman.
This is the friend?
This is friend.
Okay.
Longtime friend. Went to UCLA together.
So he has friends.
So, well, like one friend, her. Okay. So, and interestingly enough, like her side story is pretty interesting. Like her family comes from a long line of like mobster people, very rich, criminal-minded people. And both of her parents died when she, I believe, like around 12 years old. So she had this like loyalty to friends model in her life because they became her family.
Okay.
So lifelong friend. She actually had given a public alibi after his wife's disappearance.
Oh, she was around in those days.
Yes. She was the daughter of David Berman, the gangster in the 1940s from the Flamingo Hotel and the casinos in Las Vegas. On December 24th, 2000, Berman was found murdered, execution style, in her home in Benedict Canyon, LA.
Huh.
So this was interesting. I actually heard the 911 report. It was a neighbor who called in to say that they had found her dog wandering around the neighborhood because the side gate was left open. And so they got the dog. It was a very busy street. So they were like, you know, we were concerned. Her car was in the driveway. They went and knocked. She didn't come to the door. There's packages piled up. And obviously the dog being out in the back door was wide open. So they called the police saying, hey, okay, you know, we're concerned. They said, you know, is she elderly? Well, no, but you know, someone could slip and fall. You know, they were just concerned. So that's how it all initiated with checking out Berman's house.
So are we thinking that she helped like hide the remains of the wife?
And potentially. Then
she had to be killed because she knew too much?
Well, what we do know is she gave the alibi, and there's also suspicion that she was the woman who called the school to say that she was out sick.
So we don't know if she was involved in the killing, but she helped cover things up.
Yes. And so I actually have my own theories about this, that she, you know, being a close friend, maybe thought that she went missing, and, Durst may have asked her for favors at the point when it looked like, you know, my wife is missing, I need help, but, you know, I just need time. You know, I could see that. And then once things start getting stretched out more and her realizing her involvement, she may have said, you know, I don't feel comfortable with this. I need to go tell someone, or you need to go tell someone, something like that.
The MO is totally different. Like,
yes. And this is where serial killer starts to not, I mean, technically, yes, three people. However, each one of these is very different and doesn't, because typically a serial killer is for someone, you know, it's someone they don't know, but maybe fits a type. Maybe someone that they've known, but a type of person.
Do you think
that
he could have contracted a killer?
He made in the 2015 interview with the police officers, he made a statement because they said, you know, if somebody were to do this, and he like cut them off, and he's like, it could have been two people. Who's to say that it was one person? Like,
God, what?
I know.
And, like, just stop talking.
Yeah, no, he just keeps watch the HBO series. It's good. But yes, and he just kind of kept putting his own foot in his mouth. And then this next part was really interesting. So a few days later, the police department received a handwritten note postmarked December 23rd. Okay. The day they found her body was December 24th.
Okay.
So the day before they found her body, they received this letter, handwritten letter, at the police department that said it had her address on it and the word cadaver.
What?
Interesting word, cadaver, when your wife was a medical student. Who uses the word cadaver? Right?
I mean, what would I put? Dead body?
And why would you send that?
why would you send
before
it?
She's even found, which means you're obviously wanting her to be found.
Well, and leaving the door open isn't going to...
Yeah, like there's
help the yeah. finding. Like, why did it help it along so much?
Yeah. So there's all these like, wait a minute. He
probably thinks he's being like so crafty, so tricky.
Yeah, like, and you can see him too in the court trials, like he's saying exactly what he's been told to say, and you can tell because he kind of like looks away and he's just talking. But then when they say something that strikes a chord, which when they talk about him dressing as a woman, which we'll get to in a minute, he turned his wheelchair around to stare at the prosecutor who was saying, like, you could tell he just was infuriated.
Oh.
And that his own defense team had to get up and turn his wheelchair around in the courtroom. It's okay.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I mean, so that narcissism, when that gets hit, like, he can't even help it.
Like,
it
he
just
needs to
comes
be
up.
In control the entire time.
Yes. And he took the stand and had just.
How'd that go?
It was 3 weeks of just the cross-examination because they had so many questions, and he had just screwed himself by, one, being in a TV show.
They could just bring up interviews from the TV show.
Yeah, it was the TV show, and then his voluntary interview with the police where he made statements trying to get an you could tell he was trying to get a plea bargain. And he wasn't convicted of anything. He wasn't even charged with anything. An innocent person doesn't try to get a plea bargain before they even know they've been charged. Right?
Well, it's not
it doesn't make
good
sense.
Strategy.
No. But he thought he was caught. He thought they knew more. And he even said, well, Berman mentioned that she got a call from the police and was talking to the police. So he said that, right? The police said, she never contacted us. Which leads them to believe that she told him something about wanting to turn him in or do something with the information.
Yeah.
Or else why would he assume that she had already talked to somebody and he had already assumed they knew more than they did?
Yeah, maybe she was trying to urge him to confess.
Yeah,
and
if
that
they
was
were
her way
besties,
of saying
yeah.
that, well, the police have already contacted me. I haven't said anything, but maybe they're getting close.
Or he that was up. that might just even be his way of trying to say, like, hey, I know that you guys are on to me through her, even though he didn't actually know. She probably just wanted to tell somebody. Hmm. So interesting stuff. So this note anyway, so he was known to be in Northern California days before Berman was killed and to have flown from San Francisco to New York the night before Berman's body was discovered.
Okay.
Okay. Berman had recently received $50,000 from Durst in two payments. Although Durst confirmed to LA police that he had sent her $25,000 and faxed investigators a copy of that deposition record, he declined further questions about it. So
we don't know what that money was for.
Mm-mm. Huh. Yeah.
A lot of money.
Which to me kind of goes on that side of maybe she was given hush money, but then maybe she didn't feel comfortable or that didn't matter and he had a plan anyways.
Yeah.
So in 2005, Berman had a disposition that called him shortly before, that Berman called him shortly before her death to say the LAPD wanted to talk. Oh, I already hit that. Yeah. So then this really interesting part happened. So Durst went into hiding basically after this happened of his own choice. After this happened, he went into hiding in Galveston, Texas in 2000.
Okay.
Disguising himself as a frail woman to avoid police he took the name of someone he actually went to high school with. She actually was on the FBI's most wanted list for a long time was her name, even though it wasn't her. And he was renting a room in a building for $300 a month, like super, super cheap. He paid a year in advance.
So one of those where you like share a bathroom and have a hot plate.
I think they, I mean, he had it was a full room. I saw the inside of it, like a full room, kitchen, everything.
Wow, that's a deal.
Yeah, right? So
did that disguise work then? He got away with it for a while. Nobody suspected he was in hiding. Do we have photos?
I don't think anyone was like that, like onto him at this point.
He so went into hiding
before anybody was like early. Pursuing him.
Okay. Yeah. So he could have gone into hiding and not worn a disguise. Could have just gone on a trip or something.
Yeah. So he basically just instantly went into his life as a fugitive. That's what he went into. He didn't use credit cards, his social security number. He actually, I forget what it was about, but he found a way to get somebody's social security number and use that in order to open his utilities. Like very crafty with those things. Okay, so he's doing all this. He's hiding, but this woman who's he's impersonating, everyone kind of comments like, yeah, flat-chested woman, you know, because they asked, like, was she attractive? They go, I wouldn't be attracted to her. Obviously, not even, like, a great disguise. The apartment totally did not look like a woman lived there. Definitely very bare, no personal items really at all.
So he wasn't good at this.
No. And supposedly her brother, something like that, would come and visit her.
The real life brother of the person?
No, he would say that he was her brother. They never appeared in the same place.
Oh my God. It's like a bad movie.
It is. And
so he's both people.
Yes.
Okay.
More, and so basically what they would say is that she would travel a lot and that's why she would be gone frequently and her brother would come and stay.
Or is he just like lazy about putting on the costume at that point?
I mean, probably. Because, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
He could have just cut his hair and dyed it and put a mustache on.
I mean, obviously he felt a certain way about it in the court hearings when he like turned around and was like livid that the guy was. He like had all of this written. This was verbatim from his own mouth, detailing every day. Listen to the whole thing. Detailing every day of his own experience.
And he was mad that people knew about it?
Yeah, he's like, I didn't write this. And he gets up out of his wheelchair and the judge just says, sit down.
Oh.
And he just had to sit down. But like,
Wait, does he need a wheelchair?
Remember Burn Your
Why
Journal?
Why is he walking around?
He stood up. I don't know. He stood up.
Is that a disguise?
He is an older gent. Okay, so let's get to Morris Black, the neighbor in this house where he was pretending to be a woman. Oh, and a mute woman, by the way. He had a card that said, I'm mute, that he would show people so he wouldn't have to talk. Uh-huh. Tricky. Okay, so on October 9th, 2001, Durst was arrested in Galveston shortly after body parts belonging to his elderly neighbor, Morris Black, were found floating in the bay. So back to the bay. He was released on $300,000 bail the next day. Durst missed a court hearing on October 16th, and a warrant was issued for his arrest on charge of bail jumping. On November 30th, he was caught inside. They were like, how did he not know that he was going to get caught? He went into Wegmans supermarket in Pennsylvania after trying to shoplift Band-Aids, a newspaper, and a chicken salad sandwich.
Oh.
Even though he had $500 cash in his pocket, and in the trunk of his car, he had $37,000 in cash.
Oh, shit. Is he just panicking at this point?
He had two guns, marijuana, and a Black's driver's license with him, the man he killed.
So this is the neighbor.
This is the neighbor that he was just living next to. So,
it was the neighbor when he was on the lam.
Yes, on the lam neighbor, who he apparently would go and like talk to pretty frequently.
Maybe the neighbor was like, I'm on to you. You
could have been.
Don't have a
could
brother.
Could have been. Yeah. So, very interesting though, like everyone involved in this was like, what's a bigger way to be asked to be caught than that? Like, you have all this stuff on you in the car and then you steal something petty. And he's very calm. You see him arrested. And again, like you say, panicking. He doesn't look panicked in any of the he just calmly, deadpan face. It's very interesting.
So this one was dismembered.
Yes. Yes. And the person, one of the persons who saw the body parts said it was scary how precise it was. And the person had said, you know, it looked like this wasn't the first time this was done. It wasn't sloppy. It was very precise, clean.
So let's recap. The wife, they never found the body?
No, no body.
Second person killed with a gunshot looks like a professional type of hit.
Susan Berman in her house, execution style, very quick in and out of the home, very little evidence. Real quick with that one, actually, there's a lot to, I mean, it had to have been someone she knew. No forced entry, nothing stolen, nothing robbed. Her purse was sitting there with money in it, credit cards, not touched. Nothing was moved. It was someone went in, killed her, so she let this person into her home. It had to have been someone she knew.
Well,
which is him.
I think he hired someone because it doesn't match. I think like if his jam is dismembering, then he's going to be dismembering.
And I don't think that's his jam necessarily. I think I think maybe he learned that at some point. I think having a lot of money growing up, maybe he did do things to animals or think, you know, those Hallmark things, but it was covered up easier when there's a lot of attention on your family versus mm-hmm. you.
Yeah.
Because there's, I mean, all those odd behaviors. In his, as an adult, he would pee in the trash cans at work. He would burp, like belching loudly when it's like inappropriate to do so. He peed on the candy, like a candy holder thing outside of a supermarket. And like, just like really like eccentric, odd behavior. That doesn't quite make sense.
I think he knew he wasn't the favorite child.
Right? Okay, so back to Morris Black.
Sorry.
You're okay.
Allergies to something. Oh my
whoa,
God.
Whoa, whoa. okay, so he also, Durst was also using the time on the run to stalk his brother, who also admitted that he had hired extra security because he was worried about his safety from his brother.
Go. Yeah, I was going to say, like,
brother's still there.
Kill anybody, kill the brother.
Yes.
He took your place in the family business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I watched a few different videos where they play out the, like, how he said this happened. So in trial in 2003, he was tried for the murder of Black. He employed self-defense as his reason. He said he went into Black's apartment, and so first of all, they said that he was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome and spent over 70 hours examining Durst and diagnosed him with that.
Okay.
Which I didn't see any of that, honestly, in everything I saw, but who knows? Saying that his whole life's history is so compatible with the diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, his defense team argued at trial that the diagnosis explained his odd behavior, which his odd behavior included grabbing the .22 caliber target pistol, which he said Black grabbed from a hiding place and threatened him with the gun in Black's apartment. And again, this is where things just kind of don't make sense. And so they struggled and he fell and the pistol discharged, shooting Black in the face.
Okay. I don't think that probably happened.
No, probably not. During cross-examination, Durst admitted to using a paring knife, two saws, and an axe to dismember Black's body before bagging and dumping him in the bay.
See, I mean, you don't just go straight to dismembering.
He said he panicked. He said that he didn't realize what happened. So he said he shot him first, and then like he went down by the bay, paced, was smoking marijuana, got some liquor, and then like went back, sat on the bed for what could have been minutes or hours before panicking and cutting up the body.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a long panic.
Right? Black's head was never recovered.
Oh.
I know. So it was hard to dispute the struggle aspect because the actual impact of the bullet, they didn't have his head.
They didn't have the evidence.
Yeah. So there wasn't forensics for that. On December 21st, 2004, Durst pled guilty to two counts of bail jumping and one count of evidence tampering for dismemberment of Black's body. As part of a plea bargain, he received a sentence of 5 years and was given credit for time served, requiring him to serve 3 years in prison.
Evidence tampering? That's what they call dismembering? I thought it was abuse of a corpse. I thought it was something more serious. I mean, evidence tampering, that makes me think you, like, you know, scribbled out some notes you had.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, the blood was cleaned. Like, he cleaned up the blood after, too. Right?
This makes no sense.
I know. Okay, so he had to, the rules of his parole release, so it required him to serve 3 years in prison. Durst was paroled on July 15th, 2005. So the rules of his release required him to stay near his home. Permission was required to travel. That December, Durst made an unauthorized trip to the boarding house where Black had been killed and to a nearby shopping mall. At the mall, he ran into former Galveston trial judge, Susan Chris, who had presided over his trial. Due to the incident, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles determined that Durst had violated the terms of his parole and returned him to jail. So he literally ran into the judge at the supermarket, violating his parole, and then got taken back into custody.
Oops, my bad.
He makes a lot of, like, really stupid mistakes.
Stupid. Like, he should be on stupidcriminals.com.
Right? Okay. And March 2015, whether she believed he murdered Black or not, you know, all the jurors, let's hear. That might be. I actually think I was just going to repeat.
So is he only on trial for this? The last?
Yes, murder? Just Black.
Okay.
Not his best friend. Not his wife.
Okay, got it.
Just the man that he had lived next to.
Okay.
Because they couldn't find like any motive. Like, why would you do this? But also, why are you pretending to be a woman here? Like, that wasn't they.
Why a lot of things? Yeah. Why are you stealing chicken sandwiches?
Exactly. None of this just really makes sense. And what do
you need the Band-Aids for?
Right.
That's my biggest question.
So The judge said you could see that the person knew what they were doing and that it was not their first time cutting up a body. The body was cut perfectly like a surgeon who knew how to use his tool on the bone and a certain kind of tool on that muscle. It looked like not the first time this job was done. That was pretty scary. So he was acquitted.
What?
Of anything in that. And he was allowed in Texas to have it be viewed as self-defense.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't get that one.
The Jinx TV documentary is pretty ridiculous now. So this was in 2015. So all of this has happened.
The self-defense.
Yeah.
Did he pull the gun out?
No, he's saying he's saying something that like he had heard, I believe he said like he had heard a noise inside the apartment. So he came in the door. And for some reason, and I can't even tell you why, like their sketch thing of what happened, the caricatures, whatever. He goes in and like looks in the bottom drawer of the stove. I don't know why he does that. And then he goes into the living room.
His apartment or the neighbor's?
The neighbor's apartment.
So how is this self-defense if he's in the neighbor's
and
space?
And then Black pulls out a gun, apparently points it and threatens him.
Well, he's not in his right apartment.
And then they struggle over the weapon and then they fall. And when they fall, the gun fires and shoots Black in the face. And then he panic dismembers him and throws him in the bay. You know, and then cleans up the blood like any panicked person would
do. I guess I'm confused because he was in Black's apartment.
Yes, he opened the door and went into Black's apartment.
So how is that self-defense? Like, he's the one in the wrong. He's the one that should be, mm-hmm. if anybody's shot.
Well, and actually the thing that he used in that defense, because he again sat or like took the stand in that trial. He said, you know, I understand how from your perspective, this looks like I did it. I get how it could look that way, but I was just panicked. This is what happened. And that actually worked. The jurors believed him.
Don't go in people's apartments.
Right? Well, but even that, so if they were getting closer, it makes sense that Black would start to learn that you're not the woman you say you are. And again, why are you carrying around Black's driver's license? Why is that in your possession? If that was, right? Like,
yeah, that, it doesn't add up.
No.
Dots are not connecting, Macy.
So here's another one like your topic of someone not getting justice that they should have.
Damn it.
Okay, so the Jinx TV documentary, which is a 6-part HBO documentary. I'm totally watching it. On there. described the circumstantial evidence linking Durst to the murder of Berman, who is believed to have knowledge of McCormick's disappearance. The documentary detailed the disappearance of McCormick, Berman's subsequent death, the killing of Black. Against the advice of all of his lawyers, you know, he did this show and he shouldn't have. His wife, Deborah Lee Sharton, told him not to do this. Durst gave multiple interviews and unrestricted access to his personal records to the filmmakers.
Oh, he has a new wife?
Yes. Yeah.
Knowing the history, she's still in.
Brave.
In with that.
The FBI arrested Durst in New Orleans on the same day as the final episode was broadcast. The documentary ended with him moving into the bathroom where his microphone recorded him. It was hot, and he went into the bathroom thinking it wasn't recording. And this is what he said to himself.
Oh, fuck. What did he say?
He's mumbling to himself, there it is. You're caught. You're right, of course, but you can't imagine. Arrest him. I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this. What a disaster. He was right. I was wrong. And the burping. I'm having difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course.
Confession. Bathroom confession on the hot mic.
Mm-hmm. It was later learned in 2019 the filmmakers did the some of the sequences were rearranged, but those were all things he said all in that time. So it ended up being part of the evidence in the filing of new murder charges. Good.
I think valid.
Yes. And
he's not a good criminal.
No, and in that show, too, he talks about how, like, the loud burping and things, like, it was kind of like his defiantness of, like, I know what will bother people, and I'm going to do that, like that kind of controlling aspect. Yeah,
it's like a power thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now with this new Berman trial in 2015, a few days after a first degree murder warrant was signed, Durst was arrested, where he was registered under the false name Everett Ward. Durst, who had been tracked to the hotel after making two calls to check his voicemail, was observed wandering aimlessly in the lobby and mumbling to himself, having driven to New Orleans from Houston 4 days before. In addition to a .38 revolver loaded with four live rounds and one spent shell casing, police recovered 5 ounces of marijuana, Durst's birth certificate and passport, maps of Louisiana, Florida, and Cuba, and a flesh-toned latex mask.
Ew, creepy.
Yes. The fake Texas ID he used to check into hotels, a new cell phone, and cash totaling $42,631.
He's got a lot of cash.
Yeah. Police discovered a UPS tracking number, which led to an additional $117,000 cash and a pair of shoes in a package sent to Durst by a friend in New York, which was seized after his arrest. So bank statements found in one of Durst's condominiums revealed cash withdrawals of $315,000 in little more than a month. It is believed that he planned to flee to Cuba after the documentary aired.
I think he killed a lot more people and dismembered them.
And there were some talk about that there was three other younger women who had gone missing. But again, nothing formally tied.
Yeah. I think maybe he was a good criminal for a time as far as not getting caught, but just started to lose it and panic and start making poor decisions. I don't know about the one that was shot, the neighbor. I mean, the friend.
Well, and all of them seem like, so his wife seemed to be tied to money. If she was wanting a divorce, you know, again, the narcissism, the pride. So I think pride and money. And then Berman, like, it was basically to cover up the murder because she knew too much.
Yeah.
And then the neighbor, if he found out, like, kind of the other two are just covering up the first.
But I think there was other ones.
I mean, maybe again,
where he did the dismemberment thing and hit the bodies that way.
Because he's too precise, too okay with it, too. And again, in all of his testimonies, he's just so cold and disconnected, like, just deadpan. Okay, so
let's blame the parents.
Yes. There's definitely a lot there for sure.
I mean, I if that's how he sees worth is with money, you know, and he grows up knowing that there's this fortune that's going to be given to him and then it's given to the brother.
Very,
I mean,
that's going to
make
that.
Him feel very unworthy as a person, then associate like value with money.
He had some medical issues that kind of got him moved around while he was in jail awaiting trial. So they kind of moved him around for some different medical type stuff that was going on. So with the trial, a conditional hearing was convened in February 2016 where Nick Chauvin, a close friend of Durst and at whose wedding Durst served as the best man, testified that Durst had confessed to him of murdering Berman, his best friend. Chauvin was one of the prosecution's witnesses in the most recent case. So he said that it was confessed to him.
Why didn't he dismember her?
Why didn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it kind of, the note ahead of time of like the cadaver note was interesting because at first he denied the note, but in the 2015 interview with the LA police, the voluntary one, they caught him again and he said, so, okay, but you know, out of those two people, so he's like, you know, it could have been two people. He's like, okay, but you would agree with me, right, that whoever wrote that note definitely would have had to have been the killer. And he goes, yeah. Oh, no. And then later on, so they do matching of the handwriting. It looks identical. And in both the letter he had sent to Berman earlier and that letter, he misspells Beverly Hills wrong. Exactly the same on both. So his own defense team goes in and says, yes, he wrote the letter. But he wrote the letter. That doesn't mean he killed her. So
true,
but then you
an amazing coinkydink.
But then you hear that, and then you go back to, okay, but in 2015 in that interview, why would you say that whoever wrote that note killed her?
Yeah, I guess that's just circumstantial stuff, though.
It is, and
but it does make the jury, you know, start hem and haw, yeah, sway in one direction or another.
Yes, and he even said, so if you killed Berman, would you admit that? No. If you killed your wife, would you admit that? No. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So this prosecution has been going over the very long prosecution. The judge actually put a, like, there has to be a limit and ended the prosecution because it has been stretched on for so long.
Yeah,
and
I
it
agree.
Is such a big court trial. And they are hitting on all three murders, which I think does make it more complicated because they're having to prove everything along the way and show connections that even like some of them I saw and I'm like, I mean, okay, kind of a stretch. Like they bring up the cadaver point of like, he only knew that because of his wife. And so therefore he wrote the note, but like, you don't even need to justify that. I mean, it's his handwriting.
So. Yeah. I mean, people can learn the word other places.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I have heard of the word.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now they're going back and forth and the jury is still out at the moment trying to figure out what to do. It's been delayed, mistrials, and he has poor health right now. So you can tell he's just kind of like, whatever, I want this over with, basically. Mm. Let's see here.
I mean, is your feeling that he's going to get a conviction of some sort? Is he out on bail? Is he walking around free guy?
No, no.
They or rolling
have,
around
they free have guy? Him right now. the defense opened up its whole case with an extensive testimony of false memory by Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, questioning the decades ago recollections of prosecution witnesses. So they're trying to kind of write off the bat.
Yeah,
they knew.
Get rid of the eyewitness.
So diagnosis stuff.
Okay. She's pulling out the handwritten note.
Yes. Oh, which by the way, he said that all of the stuff he said in the interviews for the Jinx, he said the whole time he filmed that he was high on meth.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. The LA officer who's interviewing him goes, you know, you like straight shooter. I'm a straight shooter. I would like you to be one. And honestly, that was bullshit. But anyways, he did not look like he was high on meth. Okay, so the defense says that there is no mental health issues. That's what they're saying now. No mental health. So they're not going that way at all. At all. However,
I feel like there's some mental health.
However, again, you know, this can only be diagnosed by someone in person. This is just us throwing out for entertainment purposes only possible things that come up within everything I learned. So the first one is narcissism. So totally makes sense with wanting to do the interviews, even against legal advice. Doesn't make sense to do that, to seek out somebody to do that. Like he wasn't even pushed or pressured at all.
Right. He wanted to have that attention.
Tell his story.
Be in control of the whole scenario.
Be in the limelight where his brother is. Yeah. And then, so the third one would be like psychopathy of some kind. So that would be the emotional distancing, lack of empathy, that part that's making you think that he probably has killed other people before.
I do.
Yeah, it just doesn't.
I don't think you just leap right into dismemberment and be that good at it.
No. And we know, you know, he was physically abusive and he wasn't above hurting somebody. Obviously, we're cutting them up. Okay. And then some sort of cluster A something. I mean, for the some sort of like maybe paranoid, like schizoid, something there with the isolation, the detachment, that weird kind of like detached with how he's talking about things.
Which I think started in childhood.
Yes, I agree. But also with some like eccentricities and impulsiveness that like his behaviors just don't kind of make sense in some of these situations. The talking to himself in the bathroom, like the mumblings, not like fully like voice. This is where I don't agree with the schizophrenia, because like that would have been, there would have been more documentation about stuff around.
Well,
that.
And you described him going to school, going to college, yeah, working yeah. successfully. I'm like, well, that's pretty challenging.
And you went on the lam,
untreated like, schizophrenia.
Yeah, exactly. Like was able to have some a whole support. False identity. Like that's a lot to maintain.
Yeah.
So this would make sense with functioning, at least, would explain relationship issues. He had recognition of right and wrong, but major focus on his own needs with a total disregard of others, which again could also be some of the antisocial stuff
yes. too.
And the fact is he had a lot of money and he was an effective liar. So this is where that privilege part comes in of why this has lasted so long, why he didn't get caught in the beginning is a whole lot of privilege of money,
resources,
and power, resources.
You can just move easily.
The
if
fact
he wants
that $300,000 bail got paid the next day, I mean, that's somebody threw money at him. And yeah, I mean, his only motives in this that are clear is money, the ending of a relationship, and cover up.
And like his feelings are hurt.
Got hurt feelings, but you don't show it. I don't see hurt feelings. I don't see anger. I don't see sadness. I see no emotions at all. And I have watched at least 5 hours of just courtroom trial, and there is no remorse, no like even talking about his missing wife or, you know, any nothing.
So then it's more nothing. Like that power and control. Like
yeah, I think it's power and control.
Somebody took the power away from him mm-hmm. when he's trying to control his own narrative.
When I think because he did so well defending himself before and that worked in Texas, that he's hoping that him standing trial now will work again. But he shot himself in the foot over and over again with because his other interviews are contradicting the statements that his lawyers are having him say. And so it just doesn't look good. For him.
It doesn't sound good. It doesn't look good.
No. So, and we still don't have an answer yet, but honestly, it should be, they said by midweek and we're on Thursday. So I'm hoping maybe tomorrow, if not early next week, that we have the juror's answer and I'll be able to fill you in next week.
Are you thinking, what are you thinking?
I feel worried that they're going to acquit him because there is the fact of the matter is no matter how, and this is basically what defense is saying is like, yeah, he drinks, he smokes weed, he's a liar, but that doesn't make him a killer.
Yeah.
Yes, he panicked, but he was acquitted in that. That's not what he's here on trial for.
Right.
This is for Berman, not for Black. Separate incidences. There is no physical evidence whatsoever. No witnesses, nothing. So this is a lot of circumstantial evidence that over a long period of time that a juror has to say that there is no possibility that he's innocent. And that's hard for me to – I'm worried. I'm worried that yeah. he's going to be let go because they can't concretely say that.
Right, because it has to be without a doubt
without
that they're
a
guilty.
Doubt. Yeah. So –
the brother needs to get some security if he gets
which
out.
He has money. So, but yeah, so I think he's also very, very old. I don't think he would do it himself, but again, he could hire somebody.
It's always time for one last hurrah.
Did he do it? Did he murder 3 people? I say yes. What do you say?
I don't know.
You're going to have to watch the Jinx.
Yeah, I need to watch the Jinx.
I think it'll solidify it for you once you see him. Yeah, yeah. He reminds me of many serial killers we have talked about in the past, but more on the...
He's got those Ted Bundy glasses.
Yeah, he reminds me more of Ted Bundy in the interviews than like how we talked about Ed Gein, where it's like developmentally... Right. There's so stuff.
He's like more intellectualizing stuff.
More intellectualizing. Okay. Totally thinks he's ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. Well, he kind of was. He was way ahead of it.
I know. He like jumped the gun on everything.
Too ahead.
He literally caused murders to prevent. Why are you on the lam a day after someone went missing and we like didn't even raise an eyebrow at the letter you sent us? So
Yeah. So calm down.
Calm down. Well, there you go. So now you know of a current event one, and we'll hopefully get some closure on it soon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Something new to keep me up late at night.
Durst.
Got it. It's
Robert
D-U-R
Durst.
Or
D-U-R-S-T in okay. HBO series.
Got it.
Okay. Whew, that's all I got.
All right.
Well.
Until next time.
No means fucking no.
I was about to say the same thing. Rape is rape. Rape is fucking rape.
And murder and dismemberment is fucking murder and dismemberment. It's not, what did they call it? Oh,
tampering with evidence.
Yeah,
dismembering is not tampering with evidence.
Get your definitions right. All right, bye guys.